On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. For most of us, Italy is associated with cappuccino, fine leather, and great art. But among all the culture, it turns out, it is a hotbed of international espionage. It's where forged documents that led to the Iraq War were cooked up, and where secret abductions have been carried out. Italian investigative reporter Carlo Bonini has been uncovering this Roman spy's nest, and big names in American journalism are listening to him. Now, we can too. This hour, On Point, the Italian connection in the war on terror. Joining us now from Rome, Italy, is Carlo Bonini, investigative reporter in Italy and co-author of the new book Collusion, International Espionage and the War on Terror. He's part of a dogged investigative duo at the Italian newspaper La Repubblica that has scored some of the biggest scoops since 9/11. Carlo, it's so nice to have you with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Jane. It's a pleasure for me.
Thank you. And in the studio today here in Boston, our own Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst and senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, great to have
hello,
you.
Jane. Hello, Carlo.
Hi, Jack.
Carlo, you are a big deal in Europe, the Woodward and Bernstein of Italy, as we say, but most Americans really haven't heard of you yet or your investigative journalism. So get us off and running here and start us off by describing the most significant story in your book, which is the origin of those 16 words that we just heard from President Bush. Explain the Nigergate yellow cake scandal, how it started.
Well, it started back in the fall 2001, to be precise, October 2001, when for the first time the Italian counterintelligence service, named SISMI, sort of Italian CIA, exchanged the first piece of information with the CIA. Basically, the Italians informed the CIA that Niger had struck a deal with Saddam in order to send 500 tons of yellowcake ore to Baghdad. Obviously, the information was one of those thrilling ones. September the 11th, an administration eager to find out the possible responsibilities of Saddam Hussein and possible links to Al-Qaeda. And the information made its way to Washington and probably, did much more way than it was thought to do. What happened was that once the information arrived in Washington, the CIA asked for a sort of follow-up, and the Italians in the first 2 or 3 months of the year 2002 gave other pieces, other details, quite annoying ones. The Italians pretended to have collected enough intelligence to prove that the deal had a sort of written statement, and the Italians informed the CIA that the deal had been struck back at the end of '90s, to be precise, back in 1999. After a long journey from of the former Iraqi ambassador to the Vatican in Niger.
So what was the Italian government thinking, giving this kind of intelligence to the United States, and what was their motive in doing so?
Well, you have to know, Jane, and probably you remember, who is listening probably remember well, that Berlusconi at that time had just won the general elections in Italy, had just became prime minister. He was of a center-right government. At that time, he didn't make any secret of his willingness of having a preferential relationship with the White House of George W. Bush. And that piece of intelligence was more than a smoking gun for the U.S. administration. I would say it was a mushroom cloud, because if true, that intelligence could prove that Saddam had restarted his nuclear program, and that put Saddam at that point in a completely different light to the eyes of, let's say, not only the U.S. public opinion, but of the entire Western audiences.
In your book, Carlo Bonini, you say that the forged documents used to essentially sell the Iraq war had been, quote, scrubbed of the clues that the Americans needed to detect that they were forgeries. How do you know that they were scrubbed?
Well, there is here a written evidence. It's not a speculation. If you, everybody can read what the final report by the overseeing committee, U.S. overseeing committee on secret services, released a couple of years ago. In that report, you can read that when the Italians gave the information to the Americans, apparently, no inconsistencies, no mistakes, no other, strange things popped up from the information that the Italians exchanged with the CIA. Now, if you look at the documents, which are basically the only base on which the information was built, the documents are completely full of mistakes. And they are so badly forged, those documents, that it's almost impossible that no one noticed the inconsistencies in names, in dates, that those documents carried.
Jack Beatty, jump in.
Well, Carlo, when you show how this originates in a sort of in a break-in at the Niger embassy in Rome, led by this freebooter Rocco Martini, mm-hmm. who's out to make some money. He takes these documents, he forges them in a crude way, getting dates wrong, as you point out, and other things, and ginning up this whole, sort of Potemkin connection between Saddam and Yellowcake. And then he tries to sell it to the French, and they say this is just nonsense. And then he finds a more receptive audience with the Italians, and then the most receptive audience of all over here. And, I had to keep banging myself on the head with your book as I was reading this, the opera bouffe details here of Rocco and his doings, and then thinking this made possible what the Pope 2 weeks ago for his Easter message called the slaughter in Iraq. This was the key thing, no less than Paul Wolfowitz said, quote, as you quote him, the decisive argument in gaining the consent of American public opinion to military intervention in Iraq was Saddam's nuclear connection. And yet it was fraudulent from the completely fraudulent by patently criminal freebooters.
And this character, Rocco Martini, Carlo, who was he? An Italian operative? He once worked for the Italian intelligence service?
Well, Rocco Martino is an Italian gentleman in his mid-60s, a former police officer, a former secret service officer. Back in 2001, an Italian freelance swindler in the shadow world of the intelligence. He peddled sometimes for pocket money in exchange of information, no matter if true or false. Now, Jack just said something I completely agree with. I must add that what happened was possible because the plot of the whole story had a second, key chapter. Probably the Americans, the U.S. administration, the American public opinions would not have been fooled if the Italian Secret Service would have done another important move back in 2002. Let me say this. Once the Italians sent the information to Washington, they sent the same information based on the same forged documents to the British intelligence. And that is a key point. When Vice President Dick Cheney, back in February 2002, end of February, beginning of March, asked the CIA for a double, triple check in the story, one of the things that the U.S. administration used as a key argument was that the British intelligence had the same kind of information. So what happened there was that the same hand, Rocco Martino's hand, fed two different mouths, the British one, the American one.
We're talking with Carlo Benigni. He's co-author of the new book, Collusion, International Espionage and the War on Terror. He's part of a dogged investigative team at the Italian newspaper La Repubblica. They broke the story that Iraq's alleged pursuit of nuclear materials in Niger, which President Bush cited in his speech before the Iraq War, was based on forged evidence. Also with us in studio, Jack Beatty. He's On Point news analyst and senior editor of the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, start us off in this segment by getting us going again on how this information reached Washington.
Well, in the fall of 2002, the president wanted to deliver a speech at Cincinnati citing this yellow cake stuff. And George Tenet, the CIA director, called up Hadley, assistant national security advisor then, and said to him, quote, this is from Bob Woodward's book, you need to take this blank sentence out because we don't believe in it, Tenet said to Stephen Hadley. So Hadley took it out of the speech. Well, then comes, that's October, then comes the January State of the Union speech, and it's in there. And what happened? Well, Tenet said, basically the White House blamed Tenet, and he was furious because, of course, he had said, take it out. And then after a while, Hadley admitted, this is Hadley, he said, I should have recalled at the time of the State of the Union speech that there was controversy associated with the uranium issue. Now, I suppose you can believe that that was an honest mistake, or on the other hand, you can see malevolence there, that he didn't forget, that he remembered, and that they stuck it in there because they knew that was the dominant fear card, the nuclear issue. But that's how it came to get in.
Carlo Benigni, what lessons can we draw from this incident now that we know the truth about this particular incident?
Well, I think that the lesson is that the most vicious tool that was used broadly used after September the 11th to sell political decision, key political decisions, was what we call in the book competitive intelligence. Competitive intelligence is a well-known word in the world of the insiders, and is a disinformation technique. Competitive intelligence only appears to multiply the number of sources. In reality, it's a vicious circle. Once they have been manipulated, hypotheticals, like in the story of the Niger Gate, turn into facts.
So intelligence, since 9/11, it's evolved, you say in the book. Have Western agencies gotten better or worse?
Well, competitive intelligence brought the United States, as well as the rest of United States allies, and at the brink where we are now. I mean, I think it was absolutely a disaster. Competitive intelligence, disinformation, and manipulation techniques were used for the first time to buy the domestic audience. The competitive intelligence was normally used to break the enemy ground. This time was used to buy the friendly ground. And just to add a couple of things to what Jack was saying before, I don't know. We were not there, unfortunately. We don't know what happened in the White House a few hours before the State of the Union address back in 2003. But we do know what had been happening before. Now, the Cincinnati, Tenet. There were a couple of things more. In 2002, the French intelligence, on request of the CIA, had been double-checked the Italian information on the uranium. And the French intelligence ruled them out. The French intelligence, with very bold and clear information, said to the Americans that that intelligence was junk intelligence. One thing more. In October 2002, the forged documents finally made their way to Washington, so everybody could see with his eyes that there were forged documents. So I think it's a little bit, you know, generous to think to just a simple mistake here.
Let me turn for a moment to the famous aluminum tubes that were discussed by American officials in the months leading up to the war in Iraq and written about famously by Judith Miller in the New York Times, among others. They also have an Italian connection, which you speak about in the book. What is it?
The tubes, we say in the book, the tubes were the tube story was the second leg of the whole scam. Because if you have the uranium, then you have to build a centrifuge in order to enrich it. If you don't have centrifuge, you don't do anything with the uranium. So the tubes story was fundamental. The U.S. intelligence community, as well as the U.S. administration, Colin Powell, former Secretary of State Colin Powell, among the others, were convinced back in 2003 that those tubes, which had been bought by Iraq, were bound to build centrifuges for the enrichment of uranium. Now, those tubes were bound for another kind of use. They were bound to replace a conventional weapon system, I mean, conventional missiles, for a weapon system that Iraq had bought from Italy back at the beginning of the 80s.
So a missile system based on an Italian design.
Exactly. And the name of this Italian design was Medusa 81. Now, the Italian intelligence had the information. The Italian intelligence didn't ring the bell to the U.S. intelligence, never said to the U.S. intelligence that those tubes were for another kind of use.
Why not? What's the motive for not doing that?
Because the war probably had been decided. The White House had decided to go on war in Iraq. No one in Italian intelligence wanted to mess up the final decision of U.S. And in fact, as you can read in the Silberman report, the Italian finally released this information 14 months after the Iraq invasion. 14 months.
But I guess I don't quite understand, because Italy has not been particularly supportive of the United States. What do they have to lose? What do they care? Why not just pick up the phone and give the information?
Well, again, I think that the war on terror was, from the Italian point of view, from the Italian perspective, from the Italian government perspective at the time, was an incredible political opportunity. Again, the relationship between Silvio Berlusconi and George W. Bush are not secret to anybody. I mean, Silvio Berlusconi would have done everything in order to please George W. Bush, and on the field of the intelligence, I mean, the intelligence field was perfect, because when you operate in that kind of field, you can always say, oh, I'm sorry, I did a mistake. But if the mistake comes up, if the mistake doesn't come up, you will be always regarded as a good friend, as a good intelligence gatherer. So that's what happened. I mean, it was an incredible, wonderful opportunity to the center-right Italian government to please the U.S. administration.
Jack Beatty, jump in.
Well, you know, the man who did not tell us about these tubes, his name is Niccolò Pollari. He was the head of the Italian, essentially their CIA. he sat silent when he came here and did not tell our people that these tubes, that he had the specifications for the Italian missile, that these tubes were to fire. And he held that information back. Now, you know, at some level, that's the action of a hostile government, right? I mean, that's the action of a government that wants the United States to perpetrate a disaster. And yet he sat there and he didn't say anything. And, you know, if an enemy had done that, we'd say, my God, we've been forced into the, you know, we've been led into this disaster by our friends. But of course, it's not just Mr. Polari, it's our people. They knew, or they had reason to know, or they should have known about those tubes. And I turned on the television last night to look at an NPR documentary from some years ago, PBS documentary, and there was Colin Powell at the UN in February 2003 saying, here are the tubes, here are the specifications. And yet there's stuff on the record that our government even then knew about these tubes.
Carlo Bonini?
Well, I do agree again with Jack. The problem here is that there is also an Italian. Let me say this. I mean, I'm an Italian, so I can say that this. There is an Italian touch in this story. As you can see, as well as in for the Niger yellow cake, for the tubes, you have an Italian intelligence that loves to be in the big game, but without taking any kind of responsibility for it. It's a typical Italian attitude. I mean, it has been a typical Italian attitude after September the 11th. We wanted to fight the war on terror, but without taking any kind of responsibility or accountability for the information or for the decisions we finally came out. So, again, I think it's, unfortunately, I'm sorry to say it because I'm an Italian, but it was absolutely typical. Polari and Berlusconi were in the game, ready to gain again ready to get the big thank you from Washington for what they had been looking for, but they didn't want to take a responsibility. In fact, and actually, when the whole story broke out, Sismi as well as Silvio Berlusconi just kept silent. They simply, had nothing to say. At the very beginning of the story, I mean, when we exposed the story, they pretended not to know the story from the beginning. They said, "Oh, Niger, uranium, we don't know anything about that." At the very beginning, then when the story unfolded, it was clear that they couldn't be on that kind of defense line, but they didn't basically give any kind of answer. And I think that they still owe some answers to the Italian audience.
Carlo, you say that this man, Polari, was fired in 2006. Was he fired for this?
Well, there were many reasons for the new government, center-left government, to get rid of him. For sure, Niger was one of those. There was the Abu Omar case, was another one, and Abu Omar is an Egyptian cleric who was abducted back in February 2003 from Italy to Egypt. There was a trade-off. Polari was fired. But all the official investigations on this story in Italy, at least, were shut down. I mean, no one is going to fuss around about the Italian intelligence in the months and the years before the Iraqi war. So there was a sort of political trade-off. I mean, Polari stepped back, and the government will probably ensure some sort of silence in the upcoming months and years on all this stuff.
Well, then, so the question begs then, what sort of collaboration or relationship, if you will, have the Italians and the Americans or their intelligence communities had since this has come to light, or since the war in Iraq?
Well, I think that the relationship they had were badly damaged by this story and by other stories. You don't have to forget the so-called chapter on the policy for rescuing and releasing hostages. So I think that definitely this kind of relationship had to be reconsidered and probably to be rebuilt. I do know that recently the general consideration for the Italian intelligence in Washington is probably one of its lowest points in the Italian intelligence history. And I can also figure out that the U.S. administration is not satisfied with Berlusconi's attitude. I mean, what had been Berlusconi's attitude? Because at the end, at the very end of this story, the damage was terrible. Not only for the people dying in Iraq, but also in terms of, from a political point of view, I mean, terrible damage.
Jack Beaton.
Yeah, you know, and one of the aspects of the tubes, some of Saddam's people said, well, these are for artillery and so on. But there was also the Iraqis were half wanted to get across the idea that they did have nuclear weapons to deter us. And so they didn't lay out all their evidence on this at all. So it has that side, too. Saddam wanted to keep us out. The tubes, which had nothing to do with centrifuges, were a could be used if we thought they had the nuclear connection as a deterrent to our invasion. So he kept that card very late in the game.
Carlo Bonini.
Yeah. And you know what? Again, I think that, I mean, we are discussing now the responsibilities of the political of the policymakers, of the intelligence officers. I think that looking back, there was another subject responsible for this, and I must say, the press. In the book, we say there was a perfect storm. The White House, I mean, the Italian and the U.S. government, the Italian and the U.S. intelligence, and then the press. I mean, the press played, unfortunately, a key role in that. I mean, because it was thanks to the press that the whole fake story was sold to the American audience, to the Italian audience as well.
I'd like to turn to the phones for just a moment and go to Jay, who's calling from Chesapeake, Virginia. Jay, hi, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Very interesting conversation, and I'll come right to my question. Sometime back, there was an Italian reporter that was held captive in Iraq. She was released, a quite well-known reporter in Italy. And on the day that she was released, she and her convoy came under attack at a checkpoint manned by American servicemen, where she was subsequently killed. And I am just wondering, with all of this intrigue and Italian involvement, if this is somehow connected. If I'll be happy to hang up and take my response off the air.
Thank you for your call. Carlo Bonini, any connection?
Yeah, there is one. I must say, I mean, I would say. And the connection is this one. As I was telling you before, there had been an Italian attitude in the war on terror, speaking about the intelligence, being the game without taking the full responsibility for what we were going to do. Now, the policy, the Italian policy for rescuing hostages has been always completely different from the one U.S. administration took. In the case of Giuliana Sgrena, that's the name of the reporter that we are talking about, the Italian government had paid a ransom, and the Italian government couldn't let know the U.S. administration that was happened. So when the hostage was rescued in Baghdad back in March 2004, when the accident took place, the blocking point of the American soldier was not aware that an car was carrying a SISMI officer, an Italian hostage rescued some way in Baghdad. So that accident is exactly the final dramatic result of this kind of ambiguity. Mm. That's my answer.
Another question from a caller in Middleborough, Massachusetts. Mark is on the line. Mark, hello to you.
Hi, Jane, and welcome to America, Carlo. I'm a Marine Corps veteran from Desert Storm, and I've also worked at American embassies in Central and South America, to include Argentina, which has strong Italian influence. I would like to say that the deal that the Americans did with Italy was by design, not by accident. And then I think that's done for liability purposes. Why the Americans now are trying to create jets that fly with remote pilots, no pilots in them, for liability purposes, which is why the Americans don't want to participate in international criminal courts. But I would ask for you to please kind of concentrate, Carlo, on the fact that Berlusconi's corporate empire and his control of the press, and why that would make a difference to the American government, which is really a government of the corporation, and why Rupert Murdoch's emerging economy is actually strongest now in China. So this is kind of like a merger decision. This is a reflection of government of the corporation. Carlo, I'll hang up and listen.
Thank you, Mark, for your question. I think that, as I was telling before, in this perfect storm of disinformation and manipulation, the press played a key role. No doubt, Mark, no doubt that Italy has a big problem. And, I mean, it's no mystery that Silvio Berlusconi controls, 70% of the press here in Italy. No doubt that the influence of the neoconservative circles and let's say a general wisdom in the press corp, U.S. press corp after September 11, definitely helped the press and the American audience to be fooled by misleading information. So I don't know if there is a well-planned plot behind this. As a reporter concerned with facts, I can tell you that that was what happened. And there is no doubt, again, that the press had to take some responsibility for that. I mean, probably there would have been no tube history if let's say, the New York Times would have never run that story. Or probably there would have been a story about tubes, but probably the development would have been very different.
Jack Beattie, jump in.
No, I was just going to pick up on Mark's point. I mean, I think the corporate angle comes in this way. There was no profit for any of these news organizations, the networks, the Times, to challenge this, to challenge the administration's story. No profit at all, because 2001 made Americans afraid, and people wanted action. And the press, rather than serving as a challenger of power, ratified and passed on what the powerful wanted to say. And that's because I think the dominant motive of the press, of the media, is majoritarian. Whatever the majority is feeling, that's what the press will do. It seems to me that happens again and again. Now, of course, the majority is against the war, so is the press. But it's shocking to me, having said all that, just to read that in the Judith Miller and Michael Gordon column, a piece of September 2002, they quote an administration official saying, "We can't wait for hard evidence about the tubes and so on, because the first sign of a smoking gun may be a mushroom cloud." They're quoting an administration official that weekend. Rice and subsequently Cheney and Rumsfeld all used that phrase, the mushroom cloud. So they fed it to the Times, and then they went on the networks and spread it some more, spreading the fear.
Carlo Bonini, I want to turn to one more story from your book. You talk about a strange meeting in Rome in October 2001, one that was attended by Iranian agents. And I'd like you to tell us the significance of that meeting.
Well, the meetings were held in Rome under surveillance of CISME, the Italian Secret Service, and the meetings were attended by people from the Office of a Special Plan from the Pentagon, were attended by Michael Ledeen, a U.S. citizen, well-known neoconservative AUC at the American Enterprise Institute, and well-known also in Italy for his past link with the Italian intelligence. And were attended also those meetings by Manoukher Ghorbanifar, an Iranian citizen well-known as a fabricator by the CIA. In the meetings, obviously, there were also the Iranian agents, Iranian intelligence agents. The purpose of the meeting, officially, was Afghanistan. In reality, the purpose was the leading up to the invasion of Iraq. That means two things. First, in December 2001, just 2 months after September the 11th, the decision to invade Iraq had been made. The second, after September the 11th, it was opened a shadow diplomacy intelligence channel to Tehran. And so besides what was said then and what is said today probably also about Tehran and Iran, in reality, something different was happening. I can tell you one thing more. For the book, we had the chance to talk to Francis Brooke, former right hand of Ahmed Chalabi, former chief of the Iraqi National Congress. Well, Francis Brooke told an interesting story to us. He said that a few weeks before the invasion of Iraq, he and Chalabi were both smuggled by U.S. forces and an Iranian intelligence officer through the border of Turkey and flown to Tehran, where they spent a few days in a safe house of the Iranian intelligence, exchanging intelligence about the Iraqi ground forces in Iraq. To say it in two words, a few days before the invasion, the Iraqi National Congress, on behalf of the U.S. administration, had been dealing with the Iranian intelligence in order to prepare the invasion of Iraq.
So this was Iranian intelligence agencies passing information along to the Americans through the Iraqi National Congress to support the American invasion.
Yeah, and you know, giving and probably receiving also, because you probably remember, Jane, that no more than 2 years ago, Ahmed Chalabi was formally put under investigation of the FBI for his alleged links to Tehran. Now, well, my question is, what happened to that investigation?
Well, how does the information that you just told us, how does that square with the Bush administration now, which seems particularly outraged that Iran is interfering with the situation in Iraq?
Well, you know, what struck me today is this circumstance. I mean, apparently, as far as we know, as far as we can report, the U.S. administration has been dealing for a long time with the Iranian administration, and I mean there were more than approved that Iran interfered with Iraq, but it was obvious. I mean, there was no chance that Iran would have no interference in Iraq. I mean, it's a neighboring country, so. What is interesting is what happened after the invasion. Why the Iranians decided to, or the American administration decided to split? Because at least till March 2003, there was a clear, full exchange of information. And if you exchange intelligence information about, let's say, a third enemy, then something must have happened. And I think we will soon discover, because, again, Rome is a nice place and it's an interesting place to report about, because Iran is one of the most important cities for the Iranian diplomacy. I mean, recently, Ahmadinejad, Iranian president, dispatched one of his best political ally and best political boys here in Rome as Iranian ambassador. I think that Rome will be the future setting for some other interesting stories about this.
Carlo Benigni, another call coming from Sudbury, Massachusetts. Patty is on the line. Hi, Patty.
Yes. Hi, Jane. I just wanted to just make a remark that I'm having such an emotional reaction to this information that's forthcoming in this interview. It's really excellent, and it's really eye-opening, and it's extremely discouraging. And I'd just like to say, as a parent of a son who will be commissioned as a second lieutenant in the Army in December of this year, to all of us whose children are there, what do you can you comment on this? I'm just having a very difficult time with it.
Thank you, Patty. Carlo Bonini, your response?
Well, I think that Patty has to be proud of his son, and I think that we must be, this story, some extent, we are discussing it now, proves that if the press, if the intelligence officers, if policymakers decide to, to reset the frame of the political process, of a democratic process, as it was before September the 11th, I think that we will hopefully not face such disasters as the one we are facing now. I mean, we have to learn from mistakes, and probably this is the case. And I think we are still in time to learn.
Carlo, in our last couple of minutes here, may I ask you what the Italian people think of the American administration and the intelligence services, and how does that differ from the Italian government and what they might think?
Well, I think that the general wisdom, the general political judgment of this last part of the George W. Bush administration is generally bad. I mean, Italians are looking at the Bush administration as probably the main responsible for what is going on in Iraq, for the price of not only United States, but that all the Western democracies are facing and will pay in the upcoming years. I think that what is generally sometimes described as anti-American sentiment. There is no anti-American sentiment in Europe, I think. There is no anti-American sentiment in Italy. There is a different sentiment, is a political judgment. I think that Italy had judged the George W. Bush administration, and the judgment is final. Obviously, George W. Bush is the president of the United States, so Italians can do anything about that. But that's, I think, is a situation.
The title of your book is Collusion. Are the Italians and the American government still colluding?
Well, you can never say that in the intelligence world, collusion is over. Collusion is one of the things that normally happens in the intelligence world. The problem here is the degree of the collusion and the target of the collusion. In the story we reported, the degree and the target were both so vicious and so ominous, and finally the result was simply a disaster.
Carlo Bonini has been our guest for the hour, joining us from Rome. His book, Collusion, International Espionage and the War on Terror. He's an investigative reporter for Rome's La Repubblica, major Italian daily newspaper. We appreciate your time with us today, Carlo Bonini. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jack Beatty, thank you to you as well, in studio On Point News analyst, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Appreciate your time and thoughts.
Thank you, Jane.
I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.